Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record program number 527, titled Death Trap Part 2, being recorded on September 18th of the year 2005. This broadcast is a follow-up to For the Record 471, Death Trap Part 1. It is an analysis of the geostrategic implications, not only of September 11th, but in particular of some aspects of the Bush administration's response to September 11th, namely to invade Iraq, which in my opinion was not only a mistake, but constituted the U.S. falling into a trap by the underground Reich, a trap which ultimately is going to destroy the United States. One of the things that we talked about in Side 1 was the fact that there was, unfortunately, even though there was Iraq was not involved in September 11th, there was a relationship between Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party in Iraq. It was not an ongoing operational relationship, but it was a relationship which had al-Qaeda functioning as a doomsday backup unit for Saddam Hussein in case Saddam Hussein was knocked out of the box by the Americans. Information, basically expertise about weapons of mass destruction, was communicated to al-Qaeda. Of course, basically, the U.S. kicked over the hornet's nest in this context, and the doomsday scenario was realized. The U.S. did knock Saddam Hussein out of the box, and now, we stand awaiting the next chapter in this particular episode. We're going to plunge right in and continue with the reading of a very important article from the current issue of Mother Jones Magazine. Current, as of September 18, 2005, is the Mother Jones Magazine issue of September and October of the year 2005. This is an article called In the Garden of Armageddon by Kurt Pitzer, and the article is about not only the failure of the U.S. to secure the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction scientists, but the almost compulsive inclination not to secure those scientists. One of the central figures here is a fellow named Mahdi, M-A-H-D-I, Obeidi is his last name, O-B-E-I-D-I. He was one of Saddam Hussein's most important nuclear scientists, an individual who oversaw the centrifuge program through which the Iraqis hoped to enrich uranium, to bomb-grade uranium, as noted in, among other broadcasts, For the Record at 395. That centrifuge program came from the Third Reich's centrifuge program, headed up by Gernot Zippe, and then ultimately communicated to Saddam Hussein by a German operative named Schreiber. Again, information about that in, among other programs, For the Record 395. There are indications that that same program was very deeply involved with the AQCON network that we just spoke about in For the Record 524. Once again, from Mother Jones' issue of September and October of 2005, Kurt Pitzer here talking about his contacts with Mahdi Obeidi, who showed up in a suit and tie to talk to Mr. Pitzer in downtown Baghdad. Skipping down, at first I didn't know whether to believe him, but that night at his urging, I dialed the Washington number of David Albright, a former American member of the United Nations Weapons Inspection Team in Iraq. When I explained who had given me his name, the line went silent for a moment. "You're actually talking to Obeidi?" Albright finally asked. "Where is he? What did he say?" Albright had met Obeidi in Iraq in the 1990s when the UN inspectors were dismantling Saddam's WMD programs. Saddam had kept Obeidi's identity secret longer than that of any other scientist, Albright said. If anyone could say for sure what happened to Iraq's nuclear program, it was him. The next day, we dialed Albright from Obeidi's walled garden, and the two former adversaries exchanged a long series of pleasantries, exclaiming about how many years had passed since they'd last spoken and asking after each other's health. Then Obeidi repeated to Albright what he had told me, that the Iraqi nuclear program had been dead since the start of UN weapons inspections in 1991. He spoke slowly, choosing his words with caution. "David, there are some things the inspectors never found," he said. Again quoting, "I'm speaking of some important materials and documents, but I'm afraid of saying more until I can be sure of my safety," unquote. At the end of the conversation, Albright promised to bring the case to the attention of the U.S. government and intelligence community. He cautioned us to be patient. The Bush administration, he noted, didn't seem to have much of a plan for dealing with Saddam's WMD scientists. So we waited. A dapper 59-year-old, Obeidi arrived every day to greet me wearing an elegant abaya robe. When he felt especially nervous, we met in clandestine locations, by lamplight at my translator's home or in the courtyard of an Iraqi acquaintance. At other times, we sat on plastic lawn chairs in his garden, trying to figure out how he could avoid arrest by U.S. troops as his wife and daughters served us cookies and tea. Every now and again, he would drop hints about the secrets he wanted to reveal. Then, one day, he gestured toward a spot in the garden. Buried under the lotus tree next to his rose bushes, a few feet from where we sat, he said, was the core of Saddam's nuclear quest. Blueprints and prototype pieces for building centrifuges to enrich uranium to bomb grade. 12 years earlier, he had buried them on orders from Saddam's son, Qusay, presumably, he said, to use them to restart a bomb program someday. Obeidi dug up the cache a few days later. When he showed me the four prototypes, his hands shook. The machine parts looked alien, like pieces of a futuristic motorcycle, some of them small enough to fit inside a briefcase. He explained that these components and the 3-foot-high stack of diagrams were still immensely valuable and immensely dangerous. They represented the core knowledge it would take to jumpstart a covert bomb program anywhere in the world. This was why Obeidi was so anxious. On any given day, he might be arrested by U.S. forces who would consider him a bad guy, unquote, or killed by Saddam loyalists who would see him as a collaborator, or kidnapped by some other country interested in what he knew. The decision to come forward had been a hard one. The news from Albright over the satellite phone was discouraging. U.S. intelligence on the ground was hopelessly disorganized, and there was no guarantee that American troops wouldn't imprison Obeidi, even if he offered to help them. As the days wore on, he felt the clock ticking, and sometimes his fear and exasperation would show through. Quote, "Why aren't they more interested in finding out what I have to offer?" unquote, he once asked in the textbook English he had learned as a student at the Colorado School of Mines in the 1960s. "I can answer many of their questions. Surely, for a great nation like the United States, it is no big deal to offer me security in exchange for everything I want to divulge. Why don't they help me?" unquote. I didn't have an answer. Just weeks earlier, before the invasion, President Bush had railed against Saddam for intimidating his WMD scientists and hiding them from inspectors. Colin Powell had appeared before the United Nations Security Council and warned that Obeidi's centrifuge program posed a threat to the world. It was hard to explain why, having gone to war ostensibly to get control of Iraq's dangerous knowledge, the United States was now doing so little to follow through. It's not as if the administration hasn't talked about the danger posed by Saddam's WMD scientists. Whether Iraq had actual weapons or just capabilities, unquote, didn't matter, it has long argued. Even mere capabilities could leak out to terrorist groups or the states that support them. Parenthetically, I would add that the doomsday scenario reported by Jakar would have more or less assured that just exactly that happened. And if that seems preposterous to you, listen to the scary things that follow. Continuing, during the presidential campaign, John Kerry and President Bush reached a rare point of agreement when both named the spread of nuclear weapons as the number one danger facing the United States. As it happens, Saddam's nuclear centrifuge program during the late 1980s was one of the most efficient covert nuclear efforts the world has ever seen. The scientists who pulled it off are very gifted men and women, many of whom are now out of work. Their names are still being kept secret by the international agencies familiar with their work. But a source close to one of those agencies recently said that of the 200-some scientists at the top of its nuclear list, all but three remain unaccounted for. In a country with porous borders, where everyone, but especially those associated with the former regime, is in danger every day, many experts say at least some scientists are bound to be tempted to sell their knowledge to the highest bidder. And as the Pakistani network exposed last year shows, the nuclear black market is alive and well. "Weapons don't make themselves," says Ann Harrington, director of the Committee on International Security and Arms Control at the National Academies. Quote, "Someday, somebody has to interpret how to take military doctrine and intent and make it real. Materials, particularly nuclear materials, are not something you scoop out of the dirt. The human element is critical in all of this," unquote. Nobody knows how many Iraqi scientists may have been lured over the borders into Iran, Syria, or beyond. Nobody knows because no one is keeping tabs. But several observers agree that so little attention is being paid to Iraq scientists, the war may actually have increased the chances of nuclear capabilities proliferating beyond the country's borders. Between its unemployed scientists and the disappearance of large amounts of WMD-related materials from former weapon sites, Iraq now poses a nightmare scenario, according to Ray McGovern, who spent 27 years analyzing intelligence for the CIA and afterward co-founded Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. By the way, I love the name of that organization, Veteran Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Continuing. The danger is much more acute, both from the proliferation side and the terrorism side, McGovern says, again quoting, "Before we invaded, there was no evidence that Iraq had any plan or incentive to proliferate. They didn't even have a current plan to develop WMDs. They just hadn't been doing it. Now, my God, we have a magnet attracting all manner of foreign jihadists to a place where the WMD expertise is suddenly unprotected. It just boggles the mind," unquote. Iraqi scientists have good reason to fear what might happen if they offer to cooperate with the United States. Obeidi's former boss and to Saddam's top science advisor, General Amer al-Sadi, turned himself in to U.S. authorities just before Ahmet Obeidi. He was promptly jailed and kept in custody for at least 2 years. A military spokesman told the Associated Press last year that the U.S. was also detaining up to a dozen other scientists. The chemist Mohammed Munim al-Izmirli, also said to have worked on Iraq's former WMD programs, was taken into custody for questioning in April of 2003. 10 months later, his body was dropped off in a U.S. body bag at a Baghdad hospital. He had been killed by a blow to the head. In the weeks after the invasion, I got to know Obeidi quite well. He was no Dr. Strangelove. He loved science and the pure logic of an engineering challenge, and his eyes would light up when we talked about early Mesopotamian art or American history. He said he detested Saddam and lamented how the Ba'athists had turned the best minds of his generation toward destructive ends. What he cared about more than anything was the welfare of his wife and 4 grown children. But as the U.S. occupation wore on, that seemed an increasingly elusive goal. More than a month after our first meeting, our satellite phone calls had failed to produce any kind of safe haven offer from Washington. Operatives from the Defense Intelligence Agency as well as the CIA had tracked Obeidi down through third parties, summoned him to their respective headquarters, and demanded that he surrender all he knew. The DIA agents threatened to imprison him, he told me, and then asked that he not speak to anyone at the CIA. Soon afterward, the CIA sent armed agents to his home and took away a sample of his documents, promising to safeguard his family. Then, early on the morning of June 3, 2003, more than a dozen soldiers jumped over Obeidi's garden wall, kicked in his front door, and put him and his family face down on their living room floor at gunpoint. Obeidi's wife and children watched as he was handcuffed and put in a Humvee. Evidently, the army had finally caught wind of Obeidi's significance, and just as evidently, the troops knew nothing of their own intelligence agency's contact with him. Obeidi escaped the fate of his former boss when the CIA intervened with the army and got him released. Knowing that he was a marked man, he decided that his only hope was to go public. He consented to an interview with CNN, and soon afterward, the CIA whisked him and his family off to Kuwait, where he underwent weeks of interrogations. On June 26th, the CIA posted a press release about Obeidi's cache, the most valuable WMD evidence the U.S. has yet obtained in Iraq, on its official website. It also put up digital photos of the components and even one of the key centrifuge diagrams. The pictures, which Albright says could be, quote, incredibly useful, unquote, to any regime trying to start a covert nuclear program, were online for almost a week, long enough to be downloaded and made freely available on the Internet before the agency took them down. Literally buried for 12 years, some of Saddam's hoard of nuclear knowledge got out because of the U.S. government, not in spite of it. Before we continue, note that it was the outgrowth of the Safari Club and the U.S. a quid pro quo for Pakistan's support for the Afghan Mujahideen effort against the Soviets that birthed the AQ Khan network, as we saw in FTR 524. Continuing. Obeidi now lives with 8 family members in a U.S. city that he has asked me not to name. His son and 3 daughters are learning English and looking for jobs, and he occasionally gives talks to groups of government officials. He seems more relaxed than he did when I first met him, and though he is finally able to shed some of the fear and pressure of life in Baghdad. But the thought of his former colleagues still weighs heavily on his mind. One day, as we were eating falafel from some plastic plates in the food court near his new American home, sitting anonymously among the shoppers, he asked me why he was still the only Iraqi scientist whom the United States had seen fit to take out of harm's way. Quote, "There are a number of people who could be brought here at least temporarily and make positive contributions to this society," he said. "These are very educated and skillful scientists. Surely this great nation could absorb a few more talented people," unquote. During the 1990s, the International Atomic Energy Agency and other watchdog groups compiled lists of key participants in Saddam's WMD programs. The IAEA roll call alone included about 2,000 names. One of the few that has been made public is that of Dr. Faris Abdul Aziz, a mild-mannered engineer who oversaw a staff of more than 200 working on the nuclear centrifuge program. I met him in Obeidi's garden, and he told me that in the days after the invasion, he had gone to Saddam's former Republican palace to offer cooperation to the U.S. military on behalf of himself and other top nuclear scientists. But U.S. officials only wanted to know if he knew where Saddam was hiding and where they might find WMD stockpiles. They never asked him back for another interview. Today, no one seems to know where he is. Quote, "We've been trying to get in touch with these guys for months," Albright says, "but by now they're probably so jaded and suspicious that they want nothing to do with the United States," unquote. An even greater concern is the flight risk posed by scientists one level down, the technicians who gave precise hands-on knowledge of how to manufacture WMD components. Their expertise is priceless, especially to a covert program looking for engineers who know how to put the pieces together. A source with close ties to intelligence on the issue recently told me of the case of a female scientist who worked in Saddam's centrifuge program, most likely Dr. Widad Hatam al-Jaburi. In the 1980s, Jaburi had mastered one of the most troublesome aspects of the uranium-enriching machine, the magnetic upper bearing that holds the centrifuge rotor as it spins at supersonic speeds. Her expertise on classified magnet technology was deep and extremely valuable. Quote, "From what we've learned, he has ended up at a university in Syria," unquote, the source said, again quoting, "Apparently the Syrians basically set up a refuge for senior scientists, especially those with Ba'athist connections who couldn't get any work in Iraq," unquote. This does not necessarily mean that Jaburi is working on a weapons program in Damascus. The Syrian government has stated that it had no nuclear program, despite the suspicions of many international experts. But her move to Syria underscores how loose a grasp the U.S. has on Iraq's WMD knowledge. Quote, "The proliferation risk is higher than it was before, and a chaotic situation means this technology is going to spread," unquote, says Robert Baer, who spent 21 years as a case officer with the CIA in the Middle East. If the administration had been serious about neutralizing Saddam's weapon program, he says, again quoting, "The troops would have been securing equipment at weapon sites as they invaded, and they would have been looking for scientists. It tells you that this war had nothing to do with WMDs," unquote. Shortly after the invasion of Iraq, Ann Harrington, then the deputy director of the Proliferation Threat Reduction Office of the State Department's Non-Proliferation Bureau, began a planning trip to Iraq to meet former WMD scientists and help them to get work on rebuilding the country. Harrington had a legendary track record of working with scientists from the former Soviet Union. In 1997, she had cut through the red tape of diplomacy and sent an email directly to the head of the State Research Center for Virology and Biotechnology in Siberia. The contact led to increased U.S. government funds to help former Soviet bioweapons scientists apply for civilian projects at home rather than sell their expertise on the black market. Quote, "Anne believed this was the most important thing to do," says Carl Phillips, a biological weapons expert from Texas Tech University who signed on to help Harrington in Iraq. Again quoting, "She believed in going over and putting our boots on the ground to find these people, and she was fearless," unquote. Harrington and Phillips proposed a $20 million plan to reach out to scientists in Baghdad. Their plan didn't go over well with the Pentagon, which at that point controlled the interim government of Iraq. Phillips remembers being told that, as a condition for going, they had to agree not to make a formal request for the $20 million. Once they got to Baghdad, Harrington was aghast at the scale of the looting. Her $20 million would be a mere drop in the bucket. Quote, "You can't just put somebody in a lab," she notes. "Not when they don't have a microscope," unquote. In the end, even Harrington's drop in the bucket evaporated. Never mind that the State Department had made an official announcement allocating the $20 million, and Harrington and Phillips had to make do with $2 million scraped together from emergency funds. Albright says responsibility for the reversal lies with John Bolton, then the State Department's Undersecretary for Arms Control and International Security. So, by the way, parenthetically, of course, now John Bolton is the U.S. Ambassador at the United Nations. Continuing, all of this was going to land on Bolton's desk, he notes, and he was in the camp that thinks all these scientists are criminals, unquote. Other programs to help Iraqi scientists, including a Department of Energy program coordinated through Sandia National Laboratories in New Mexico, have also come up short. There are tens of thousands of scientists and engineers in need of a job, says Dr. Arian Pregenzer, a senior scientist at Sandia's Cooperative Monitoring Center, again quoting, "We estimated it would be a $50 million a year project. That money has not materialized from any place," unquote. Phillips ended up working on his own in Iraq, traveling in a civilian car to make contact with any WMD scientists he could find. So far, he's been able to set up a small center that employs 8 former weapons researchers. Harrington, for her part, resigned from the State Department this past spring, partly in frustration over the lack of funds. Quote, "When the most we could squeeze out of the system was $2 million grants," she says, again quoting, "it made us sit back and scratch our heads a little bit and say, didn't we go to war because they had people who could produce weapons of mass destruction," unquote. It's a little difficult to square that circle, unquote. Well, it is, unless you grant that, in fact, the engineer intends to wreck the train. By that I mean the Bush administration, which I will swear is a front for the underground Reich, not George W. himself, who's a figurehead rather like Ronald Reagan. George W. basically is a spoiled expletive deleted, and he's the crowd pleaser, like Reagan, or frankly like Hitler. He's the fellow who goes out there and he grints and winks and squints and gives him that faux down-home Marlboro Man BS that seems to wash so well with a lot of people. But he's not the decision maker. I would go to the mat with anyone that the real power in this administration is not Dick Cheney, although he has a lot of power, but the real power is Karl Rove. He's the man that calls the shots. But again, this all makes no sense unless one grants that the engineer intends to wreck the train. Now, one of the people whose name looms large in the context of September 11th, even though he died in February of 1996, is François Genoux, a key Nazi spy, a Swiss national. He was a major operative on behalf of the Third Reich before, during, and after World War II. According to Ernest Bacchus, he set up the Bank Altaqua, and his name crops up in connection with September 11th in a number of different contexts. To give you an idea of how important he was, François Genoux was the heir to the last will and testament and collected literary works of Adolf Hitler, Joseph Goebbels, and Martin Bormann. And this guy is one of the most important people in the events in and around September 11th, though, again, he died in 96. There are many programs dealing with Genoux, among them the compendium about Nazi and fascist connections to September 11th. That's, for the record, 456. The description is some 30-odd pages long. And referring again to my hypothesis that the Underground Reich is utilizing the Muslim peoples of the Earth Island, and the Arabs in particular, as proxy warriors to finish the job they began in World War II, I'm going to read from a footnote in an article from the online publication Occidentalis. It's a French publication. This is from December 13th of 2004. The article is "The Reds, the Browns, and the Greens." This particular article was by Alexandra Del Valle, and in the footnote, Adolf Hitler declared in his testament, reported by Martin Bormann, quote, All of Islam vibrates at the announcement of our victories. What can we do to help them? How can it be to our interest and our duty? The presence next to us of the Italians creates a malaise among our friends of Islam. It hinders us from playing one of our better cards, to support the countries oppressed by the British. Such a policy would excite enthusiasm throughout Islam. It is, in effect, a particularity of the Muslim world that what touches one, whether good or ill, is felt by all the others. The people ruled by Islam will always be nearer to us than France, in spite of the kinship of blood, unquote. That from the Testament of Hitler at the headquarters of the Führer, April 4th to April 2nd, 1945, preface by François Genoux. And again, check out For the Record 456 for some of the information about Genoux. I would note that a close friend of, protege of, and attorney for Genoux, Baldin Dunant, was the co-chairman of the board of SECO. I talk about him in, among other shows, For the Records 498 and 499. Now, in the context of that dictation by Adolf Hitler, it is in effect a particularity of the Muslim world that what touches one, whether good or ill, is felt by all of the others. And substituting the United States there for the British, consider the following. This is from an article by Walter Pincus in the Washington Post of April 4, 2004. Spread of bin Laden ideology cited. And it reads in part, the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq has accelerated the spread of Osama bin Laden's anti-Americanism among once local Islamic militant movements, increasing danger to the United States as the al-Qaeda network is becoming less able to mount attacks, according to senior intelligence officials at the CIA and State Department. At the same time, the Sunni Triangle has become a training ground for foreign Islamic jihadists who are slipping into Iraq to join former Saddam Hussein loyalists to test themselves against U.S. and coalition forces, these officials say. And that is very, very interesting indeed. So take what was written in the Washington Post in April of 2004 with what Hitler was dictating in April of 1945, and you have a very, very, very scary scenario indeed. And where are the weapons of mass destruction? Good question. For background, please take advantage of the enormous amount of material I've put together on the web, WFMU Archiving and For the Record series on Real Audio and MP3. WFMU is podcasting the For the Record shows. Spitfire has a vast amount of information in print. Each For the Record show is turned into a written article-length description. The book Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, available in both HTML and PDF. A link to a website maintained by listeners in the Midwest that contain all of the declassified government documents proving the Bush family's involvement with Nazi industry before, during, and after World War II. Also, links to URLs from which you can download a couple of very important lectures about the future, a search function to help you search the Spitfire website, and also a page to click on for listeners to support the work that I'm doing. And if you don't like what you hear, there's no better way of doing something about it than support the work that I'm doing. And again, a profound generic thank you to those who have done so. This concludes Side 2 of For the Record 527, Death Trap Part 2, being recorded on September 18th of 2005. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.